Welcome to All Things Armenian. I'm your host, Professor Barlow Damrgardichian. Today, I'd like to welcome my guest, who is Dr. Carla Garabedian. She's on the board of directors of the Armenian Film Foundation and is actively involved in a variety of projects that I want to discuss today. So welcome to the program, Carla.
Thank you. So happy to be here.
Yeah. Actually, you have a Fresno connection. Is that right? Tell us a little bit about your early years and about your family. And
well, my mother's cousin, Joy Terigian, lives in Fresno. And so I've been back and forth visiting her and her family, her children, Marcus and Joy, Lisa, and her husband, Milton. And so Joy has been involved in the community for so long. So I associate Fresno with family. And the other association I have with Fresno is through Michael Hagopian, who I think we'll talk about in a little bit, who is the founder of the Armenian Film Foundation. He was born in the Fresno. He was born in Turkey, but then grew up in Fresno. So I've seen Fresno through Michael Hagopian's eyes, and also a documentary he made about the Armenians of Fresno. So there are a lot of different angles that I associate with Fresno.
And you've been active in the media. That's in terms of your career. You've been active in media. You've been active in film production, film direction. Tell us a little bit about how that all came about. How did your interest in that field come about?
Well, I was very fortunate to have parents who encouraged me to go wherever my interest took me, and I spent a year abroad in the United Kingdom in my undergraduate years, just 1 year abroad, and I had the opportunity to finish my degree at the London School of Economics, which was and is an amazing institution. I was initially in London for a year, but then that grew to 3 years, and then that grew to doing my doctorate there. So altogether, my academic career in London went for about 7.5 years. And in my last year of my doctorate, I got the opportunity to work on a documentary for British television, and that spun out into a career in television, producing and directing documentaries. And towards the end of maybe two-thirds of the way along, I got the chance to work for the BBC in front of the camera because they were looking for somebody to be a North American face of the BBC. They had one Canadian, but they did not have an American, so I was their first American. And that was kind of a shift because I had been producing and directing then behind the camera. To suddenly be in front of the camera is a whole other kettle of fish. So I enjoyed that immensely. I was on what they called the Asia shift. And on a 24-hour news cycle, the Asia shift for Britain was 11:30 at night to 6:30 in the morning. And so I was basically doing a night shift.
Wow.
If they had said, "Oh, Carla, you know, well, you want to come and do the night shift," I would have thought twice about that. But it sounded a lot better to say I was doing primetime Asia. But I enjoyed it immensely because the BBC has a very broad network of correspondents all over the world. So basically, you could spend that time talking to people all over the world, finding out what was in the news, and covering a lot of ground. So that to me was a lot of fun. And also there's something about live news. You go to work, you don't know exactly, you might have an idea of what you're covering, but there's a lot that happens on your shift. You don't know what's going to happen. So there's a certain element of risk and a thrill, and I'm a bit of a thrill seeker, so I enjoyed that.
And when you went to London for a year, that sounds like it was a pretty transformative moment. And I wonder if you have advice for people, let's say students in particular, that traveling overseas does give you a perspective that you can't get just living and working or going to school in the United States.
Well, that's a really good word to use, Barlow, transformative, because I've thought about the decisions I took at that time, and it was transformative. And there was a certain amount of luck involved as well, because I was taking an economic class at my father's college where he taught. My father was a professor of journalism at Los Angeles Valley College, and so he suggested I take some journalism classes. So I took some journalism classes, and also I took an economics class. And the professor there said, you know, you might consider going to the London School of Economics for a year. They have a 1 year junior abroad course. And I thought, you know, it was just a suggestion by a teacher. It never would have occurred to me to look in that direction. And he had a student that he told me to talk to, and one thing led to another, and it changed my life. And towards the end of that junior year, I really didn't want to go back to L.A. I was trying to find a way to stay and continue my academic work there. And of course, my parents weren't too happy about that, but it, you know, the deal was a year. But I managed to get some scholarship money, which was pretty incredible. And I was able to extend my stay, and then from that to move into research work, postgraduate work. So it was very much getting the help of mentors. Michael Hagopian actually wrote a reference for me because he went to Harvard University and got his doctorate from there. So people helped along the way. People suggested. I think the advice is if you feel a calling or something is pushing you to be or do something that really I don't know, it answers some sort of calling. I felt that I needed to leave the United States. I didn't know why, but I felt that I needed to push myself and I needed to understand my country by being away from it. That I felt very strongly. And also, Barlow, when I got there, I thought I was a good student. But when I got to Britain, I found out that actually I was an okay, good student, but I wasn't an excellent student. And because I'm competitive, I wanted to be an excellent student, and being at the London School of Economics, it really, really pushed me. So for lots of different reasons, I felt that making that move, and I was homesick. I definitely was homesick, but I'm very glad I made that choice.
And then after you were working, after graduate school, after receiving your doctorate, you said you were working in the camera, behind the camera, in front of the camera. And then something pushed you into documentaries and producing and directing. Tell us a little bit about how that came about.
Well, I was working for a company in the independent sector that they probably should make some sort of, you know, drama about, because it was kind of like a Charlie's Angel situation. There was one guy who got these interesting, dangerous assignments, and then would find crazy journalists who would go and do these assignments, and most of them were in conflict areas. He concentrated on human rights issues, so he was looking for people who were willing to go into some of these dangerous places and try to record, document these human rights stories. So the first one that I did was actually in Chechnya, and the story was actually an alleged war crime that we needed to go and see if it had really happened and interview eyewitnesses. So at that time, I was up for it because I had finished working for the BBC on air. I was looking for something that was challenging, and along he came. And that one opportunity led to three or four other films I made with him. So I ended up doing another film about North Korea, another film about Afghanistan, and then we did one about Iran undercover, about the student dissident movement. There have been several movements in Iran, but this was the one that we filmed it in 2004. So that was an association that started like that. And, you know, the technology changed. That made it possible to go into these places looking like a tourist, because if you went officially as a journalist, the government would stop you and say, no, you can't come in, you can't cover the story that we do not want any attention on, because usually governments are involved in these abuses, or if they're not involved, they're complicit in some way. So if you go as a tourist, you're not going to get in. But the technology at that time was changing from these big cameras to very small cameras that could actually be a tourist camera. So because of that, and this company that hired me, they were on the cutting edge of using that technology. And to a certain extent, it looked almost like you were a spy, because you had something on you, that sometimes you had a wire going up your trouser, you had the camera in your back pocket, you had a microphone coming through your button on your shirt. If anybody caught you with that, I mean, you look like you're a spy.
Right.
So, but it did make it possible for us to record things that we otherwise wouldn't be able to do. And of course, we're living in an age where you don't need that kind of technology so much because now everybody has their phone, and all they have to do is hold it up and, you know, and just record whatever's in front of them. So that's the debate. I was kind of in the middle of that revolution, going from the big cameras. Michael Hagopian, who I was talking about earlier, was in film. And then traveling around with film was a little difficult, so the video camera made it made it more easy. And then the video cameras got smaller and smaller and smaller, and now we have phones.
Well, you know, talking about documentaries, you can say that, okay, you can, you know, put up the camera and kind of show what's taking it, but you have to think about what you want to produce for the audience, right?
And
In doing so, is that how you kind of got more involved in movies and in thinking of longer term movies and in creative movies?
The movie side of my career has had its basis in really screenwriting. So I started writing about some of the experiences things that were happening to me in the field. I started writing about them in movie form. The screenplay format, for those of your listeners out there who know this already, it's a very particular kind of writing. It's a very constrained and in some ways very limiting kind of writing. Everything has to be expressed in terms of dialogue and action. And so that seemed very familiar to me because I worked in documentary. So that was the closest thing that I could find in the fictional world to match my own experience. So I first started writing in the late 90s, and then I worked out that to really get your script out there in a form that wasn't messed around with too much, with lots of people editing it and changing it, the best thing to do would be to direct the things that you write. And we call that a writer-director. And I think for me it's a necessity in order to keep the authenticity of the work to be a writer-director. I wouldn't say that I'm a director looking for work. I'm actually a writer-director who's looking to make my stories come to life on screen. So there's a kind of symmetry between documentary and film, but they are very different. But there are some parallels.
And did you basically kind of train yourself then? You started as a screenwriter, and so with documentaries, and then you began to write screenplays. Did you get training? Did you just kind of look around and see what you could maybe borrow from? I don't know. How's that process work?
Well, the first one I wrote was really by the book, and I got one of the classic screenwriting how-to books, and I just sat down and I wrote it. And then my brother had a friend in the business, and what you might call a Hollywood producer, Rocky Lang, who's the son of Jennings Lang, who produced a number of major, like big studio films, like The Poseidon Adventure, if you remember that.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah, I do.
and Airplane and all a bunch of these movies. So there's his son who's in the business, and he said to my brother, he said, "Oh, I have to tell you, you know, I don't like a lot of screenplays, but I'm going to tell your sister the truth." So my brother, you know, was shaking in his boots, thinking, "What the heck have I done? You know, I've brought jeopardy to my sister's life because what if my friend doesn't like her screenplay?" Well,
right.
It turned out that Rocky really liked my screenplay, and not only that, but he helped me to get representation and to get it out to people in the business. The first one actually was an entree to meet lots of different producers. And I was, you know, I had a fantastic literary agent who got me into different production companies. I met lots of different people. And although I never made that film, but one day I do hope to make it. So it's like they're pieces of real estate screenplays. You never know when there's going to be the right audience for them, but they're still there. And I think they gain in value over time. So, but that got me started. And the one that I'm really trying to get produced now, which is based on the Sogelman-Tullerian trial and which we hope to be filming next year, that screenplay actually has been through a number of different rewriting processes. I finished it in 2011, and here we are in 2020. But in some ways, I think the rewriting and getting different feedback and people weighing in on it has helped it. So it's a different animal now than it was in 2011. So it can be a collaborative process,
right.
and it's one that I enjoy. I think at at base core, I'm a writer, and I like filming a lot, and I like editing. Editing to me is where it all happens. But the basis of a good movie is always the script.
Now, you became involved very much recently, and I say recently, and you will talk about it, but with the Los Angeles-based Armenian Film Foundation, founded by J. Michael Hagopian, and also with the involvement of your father. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that. Tell us about the Armenian Film Foundation.
In 1975, the Los Angeles Armenian community decided that they wanted to have a commemoration that would really reach out to an American audience. And they wanted to have a documentary film that would be shown on public television. Michael Hagopian was hired to make that film, which became The Forgotten Genocide. And my dad was on the committee to help fund that and to help organize events for that 1975 commemoration. So that would have been the 60th commemoration. So that's how I met Michael, and he was actually the first filmmaker I ever came into contact with. So the Armenian Film Foundation, after 1975, it was created, I think, in 79, or when it was discovered that Michael had a lot of survivors that he wanted to film, survivors all over the world, genocide survivors. But obviously he needed to have financial support to do that, because he was working on film. Film is very expensive, a lot more expensive than video. And video wasn't even around then, or it was just the beginnings of it. So Michael was working on film. He needed help. The Armenian Film Foundation was created to support, in the first instance, his quest to interview as many Armenian genocide survivors around the world as possible. And there were still a lot of them around in the 80s and 90s. I mean, they were still, you know, a lot of them were children when it happened, so they would be able to tell their stories. So Michael was on a quest to do that, and he did go all over the world, and the Film Foundation supported him in that, and he had several films he made based on the survivor testimony, which is now called the Witnesses Trilogy, but some people will know the films by their individual names. One about Harperet, which was Voices from the Lake, and then there was one about the alliance between Ottoman Turkey and Germany, which was called Germany and the Secret Genocide, and then his last one, The River Ran Red. So all of those used interview material from those survivors that he interviewed around the world. So the Film Foundation was going to support Michael. Michael died in 2010, and luckily he thought about what was going to happen to all this material after he went. A digital form has gone to the Shoah Foundation, so now you can go to the Shoah Foundation's Visual History Archive, and you can actually not only look at those interviews, but you can search by keyword for subjects within those interviews, so, you know, but geographically or by experience. It's a great archive because it's one of the only searchable archives of interview material from the genocide, and it's also been subtitled. So for those who speak in Armenian or other languages, it's subtitled in English.
My guest, we're gonna take a break at this time, Carla, and come back and continue this conversation, especially talking about the Shoah Foundation collection, more on the Armenian Film Foundation, and more about some of the movies that you are working with. This is All Things Armenian. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with my guest, Carla Garabedian, in just a few moments.